Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, The Guardian's regular weekly dispatch from Brexitland. This week we're looking at a sector that made its fears about the potentially catastrophic impact it faces from Brexit very clear, almost as soon as the referendum on Britain leaving the EU was announced. In fact, I first discussed its concerns with one of my guests today nearly 2 years ago, back in October 2015. This is the higher education and research sector. Britain's universities and academic research establishments, centres of learning and teaching with a global reputation for excellence that, say those who work in them, owes a huge amount to Britain's membership of the European Union. Now, Brexit could affect these institutions' staff. Around 15% of teaching and research staff at the UK's 132 universities are EU nationals. It could also affect their students. More than 200,000 UK students and 20,000 staff have studied or worked at European universities thanks to the Erasmus scheme. And EU students currently represent around 5% of the UK student body, far more than that at universities in central London. And it could finally affect their funding. British universities have used EU funds to build new labs and lecture theatres. In some cases, EU money makes up to 15% of universities' overall income. And of course, with the UK's national research budget below international averages, EU money here is vital, worth more than 7 billion euros in the last 7-year funding cycle. And beyond all that, of course, is the fact that education and research are international activities par excellence. Everyone benefits from the freest possible exchange, the fewest possible constraints, the best possible collaboration. So, will Brexit end all of that? With me to answer this and other questions are Rachel Hall, who's the editor of The Guardian's Higher Education Network, Mike Galsworthy, a visiting researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and co-founder of Scientists for EU, and Alison Goddard, editor of Research Fortnight. Welcome to all of you. Mike, I'd like to start with you, if we could. You've been campaigning since pretty much the day that the referendum was called. In fact, we spoke a couple of years ago for an article about this whole issue that I was working on. Can you outline for us, sort of in broad terms, basically, how significant you feel that EU membership has been for British universities, science and research? What's made the difference?
Well, it wouldn't just be me, because during the referendum debate, there was, of course, a House of Lords inquiry into the value of EU membership for the UK. And the conclusion of that was that there was overwhelming support from the UK science and higher education community for EU membership. The main reasons centre on people, policy, and participation, collaboration. So with people, you have freedom of movement, and also you have various grants that actively support people being able to move around to the best labs within Europe, but also attract people from around the world. And mm-hmm. those have been highly successful. With policy, we've been shaping policies together with our European team, and that has been fantastically useful for bringing down barriers, regulatory barriers or policy barriers, allowing us to work together, which then sets it up for this common pooling of investment to do the collaborative frameworks that we have, whereby you can put together dream teams from right across the continent in order to do the big science, which is now beating America in terms of prestige. So it's everything that goes with lowering barriers to innovation, lowering barriers to collaboration, and working together as a team to crack the things that matter to us all. So leaving the EU immediately steps us down from that policy seat, because we give up our MEPs and we give up our position on the council.
We don't have a seat at the table anymore.
Quite. And if we throw away the freedom of movement framework, not only does that do damage in itself to mobility, but as we saw with Switzerland, it is intimately linked with how the EU has been running their science program. So could take us out of many strands of that, including coordinating some projects.
Do you just want to explain the Swiss example? Because it's quite relevant, isn't it, to where we are?
So what happened was, and it's quite a complex story, which I will make short, was that in February 2014, the Swiss had a vote on mass immigration and voted by less than a percent in order to go back to a quota system rather than to keep the free movement agreement that they have with the EU. This meant that they felt unable to sign Croatia into the whole freedom of movement scheme, which meant that the EU said, right, well, if you don't honour that contract, we can't let you into Horizon 2020, the big science programme, as full partners. So they dropped out. Then they negotiated a partial deal, a halfway house, and then they came up with a solution at the beginning of 2017, which was, tell you what, this freedom of movement framework works for our citizens, but we want to prioritize our Swiss locals for jobs. Can we have a deal whereby we advertise jobs to Swiss locals before advertising them internationally? And the EU said, yeah, go on then. And they were fully back in the science program.
So there was a compromise possible, but I mean, they were basically kicked out the moment they brought the door down on free movement.
Yes, so they were immediately out as a third country, which means that they could buy their way back in on some schemes, but in other parts of the program they couldn't, and they couldn't have coordinating roles, and so they worked furiously late into the night in order to replicate a lot of EU schemes just at the national level, including, for example, Erasmus as well, where they actually paid double for that because they paid for the students going out and they paid for the students coming in, just to keep it going, because all of these European schemes that they had been in before were incredibly valuable to how they do science and higher education in Switzerland.
Okay, well, that might be some kind of precedent, and we'll return to the importance of free movement a little bit later. Rachel, can I turn to you? You're dealing with higher education professionals every day at the Higher Education Network, Guardians Higher Education Network. How big a concern would you say Brexit is for them, and what is their biggest worry or set of worries?
Well, for EU academics, I think it's fair to say there's a lot of anxiety. They're effectively living in a sort of state of suspended animation while they wait for assurances from government around what the visa regime is going to be after Brexit. And there's a lot of uncertainty around that. And some of the reports and leaks that have come out suggest that it might be harsher than expected. Government said that they're keen to keep the brightest and best, and obviously they're referring to researchers among those. But that's not much comfort when there's also news coming out that they might not be able to, their families might not be able to come with them. They might have to apply for settled status, and who knows what kind of paperwork that involves. Or there might be a minimum salary threshold that excludes early career researchers. On the flip side, there's also a lot of reports coming out of staff being poached or attempts to poach staff from other EU universities. The provost of UCL said that 95% of his senior researchers had received approaches from other EU universities. And I suppose for UK academics, what they're worried about is losing access to funding. There's already reports that it's been difficult to find partnerships with EU academics to apply for EU grant funding, and also about the kind of access to networks that they'll have after Brexit.
Yeah, okay, well, let's pick that up with Alison, if we can. I mean, funding clearly is one of the main issues here. How important has EU funding actually been for British research and British science, and how good have UK establishments been at securing a slice of it. Can you just give us a bit of an overview of you know, what the main programmes are and how relatively important they've been?
Certainly. So in this situation, the UK is actually in quite an unusual position in that it's a net contributor to the overall EU budget. And that's one of the reasons why Margaret Thatcher famously went with her handbag and negotiated the
money back.
Rebate.
Yeah.
But on the scientific and the research programmes, actually the UK does very well out of the EU. And that is because the UK is a world-class country for science and for research. And because these monies are available through a competitive tender basis. Mm-hmm. And so the UK actually gets much more money out of the science and research budget than it puts in nominally.
And what are the programmes specifically?
So the big programme is, at the moment, it's called Horizon 2020. So this is the eighth of the framework programmes that have been running by the EU since, I think, 1984. Mm-hmm. And so this programme, it's a seven-year programme. It's thematic, and universities can apply for grants in collaboration with other researchers based in various countries. At the moment, Horizon 2020 is open to countries from outside the European Union. And so one of my sort of questions is, I do believe that Brexit is going to happen. I don't believe it's in the national interest for it to happen, but we are where we are. Mm-hmm. And I think really now universities have to make the best of what they've got. And so I think the crucial thing will be to negotiate with the EU in such a way that the UK can retain some of the benefits it has from its membership of the Horizon 2020 programme. And also, I think possibly, you know, to look at the ways in which international collaborations have been possible prior to EU membership, and to see whether there are ways of exploring how we retain those vital international links whilst at the same time letting go of the EU membership.
Of European membership, yes. I mean, they will all require some kind of conditions or payments or exchange, one imagines. Mike, there are other programmes as well, aren't we, that Britain is actually particularly strong in, the European research grants. The kind of like the highest level, if you like, of scientific work, a lot of which is done in Britain with continental European researchers.
Okay, so to break down the set of schemes that we've got on the go, if we deal with the main science programme first, Horizon 2020, which runs from 2014 to 2020, the main things that you should know about it within it are grants for exceptional individuals, like the European Research Council grants and the Marie Curie grants, to go to labs and other places and do very high-level work. There is also the main bread and butter of the programme, which is the international collaboration grants, where you can put together 7, 8, 9, 12 countries all working on the same thing, and these things can run from 3 years to 5 years. There is also support there for a lot of small businesses, small innovative business, and sometimes large businesses to work with universities within those clusters. There's a special instrument to support small businesses, and there are also joint programs between large industries and academia, such as the Innovative Medicines Initiative or other initiatives around aerospace and car manufacturing.
And what sort of budget are we talking about here? I mean, what's the global number that's been coming into the UK in within these frameworks?
So there is about 1 billion euros per annum coming into the UK from the Horizon 2020 framework. I think there's a few hundred million as well that comes in via structural funds, which complement this science program and are dedicated to boosting the infrastructure of struggling regions. And increasingly, that involves supporting a lot of research and innovation activities. And that's been very useful to areas such as, for example, Northern Ireland and supporting industries there.
But we are talking about a whole kind of ecosystem that's grown up over the 40 years of the UK's membership of the EU, aren't we? I mean, it's going to be a tremendous wrench to possibly lose that, and replacing it is going to be a very tall order, Rachel.
Yes, that's true. I mean, governments also they have outlined some ideas about things that might replace some of the programmes. And in the industrial strategy, there was an extra $2 billion pledged for science and innovation that's intended to sort of help out with the transition. But it's certainly going to be difficult. There's a lot that will need to change, and new systems that need to be negotiated. Erasmus is another one where the UK might choose to do their own student mobility programme to replace the EU one. And as you mentioned, the structural funds are the structural funds. They're an area where the UK pays in more than it gets out, so it might prefer to look for its own substitute for those as well.
Yeah, Alison, you want to come in?
Yes. Science is an inherently international thing and has become ever more so. So in 1981, 90% of what the UK produced was domestic. It's now less than half. And yeah, that's an incredible trend that's ongoing. And I think the trick will be to retain that internationalism whilst losing membership of the European Union. And I'm sort of looking to those institutions, those European institutions that were set up prior to the formation of the EU. You're trying to see whether there are some lessons there that we can learn. So I'm thinking about things like CERN, the particle physics laboratory that's outside Geneva. Yeah, that's completely separate from the European Union, and the UK will retain its membership. Other agencies like the European Space Agency, again, you know, this was founded prior to the establishment of the European Community and then the European Union. But it's since sort of become ever closer to the European Union with a view to it becoming a European Union agency. And that is why the UK participation in the Galileo programmes of positioning satellites and the Copernicus Earth observation programmes are at risk. And it's because the EU has co-opted a existing scientific organisation to become one of its agencies. And I'm just sort of wondering how you go about unpicking that. That's going to be the task for the next two years and beyond.
That sort of divorce process. And this might be the moment to bring in the Euratom question. Where do we stand on that? What are the big issues around Euratom?
To have a word firstly about the Copernicus and Galileo programmes, the European Space Agency is independent of the EU, but it has been doing these programs in collaboration with the EU because the EU has been funding it. So when it enters areas of security, for example, in some of those satellite programs, and the EU is funding it, then that starts jeopardizing outside partners. So that's where you've got some of the issues that need to be sorted fairly. Yeah, but you do have those overlaps. And to make the broader point, European science is a fantastically beautiful ecosystem wherein you've got a lot of bodies that are completely independent of the EU, some slightly overlapping with them. And then the EU is also the glue between a lot of nations in order to replicate that multinational collaboration feel that we do so well in Europe, specifically for a whole set of different projects. So it's about finding our feet in the ecosystem after coming out of the EU, which is the tricky thing, and it will take multilateral and bilateral new structuring in order for us to stay in there in a healthy way and also have a policy voice, which otherwise we would lose.
And to replicate what we have now. And Euratom, you were going to?
So Euratom is a treaty from 1957, one of the original treaties. It remains its own treaty, but it has become governed by the institutions of the EU for efficiency. So the Council, the Parliament, the Commission, the European Court of Justice. Did we actually need to leave it is still an open legal question that was not resolved in any court, and you have different opinions on it. But as described in an inquiry by the business committee of the government, the decision to leave Euratom was one made by Theresa May herself, the Prime Minister herself, and they believe it to be based on the European Court of Justice having jurisdiction over it, and that crossing her red line. And they quote it as an unforeseen and unfortunate consequence of this red line. So there is still a lot of debate around it, that whether this was a good idea or not, because there wasn't adequate preparatory work done by the civil service or adequate communication to the nuclear and research communities about this. So we're now stuck with basically three options on it. One is to try and fix it ourselves within the two-year time period, and the nuclear industry say that basically that's not going to happen, mm-hmm. especially with the international agreements that stem from it. The second one is to hope that we can get some kind of associate membership. The risk with that is that there are tons of frameworks that we're trying to keep after we get past the divorce bill, and it's going to be a lot trickier than we think, because part of the Euratom deal is free movement of nuclear scientists. And then the third one is to say, well, let's just revoke our withdrawal notice for Euratom, and then we can continue as normal if the EU will give us that blessing, and then we can work this out further down the line. But let's take it off our plate for the moment, because we are losing out already through the uncertainty and not knowing whether a deal is going to come through.
It is interesting, isn't it, how often we come back to these kind of unintended consequences of red lines, government red lines, like free movement, like the role of the European Court of Justice. It's a recurring theme. Rachel, you mentioned earlier, there's clearly a personal dimension to this as well. Mike, I know you've been collecting stories. We've spoken before about EU academics who've decided to leave or have already left. And, you know, the evidence is as many as 1,300 EU academics may have left over the course of the last few months. You mentioned the provost of UCL saying 95% of his staff had already been approached by EU institutions. How real do you think is this prospect of a brain drain of top talent, and you know, does it, the corollary of that presumably is that fewer people will be applying? Are we seeing this already?
Well, there's been a 30% increase in the number of EU staff leaving their universities over the past couple of years. So, I mean, that's some pretty clear evidence there. I think within institutions, I've received emails from academics who say that they feel they're being overlooked for promotions because of this feeling of uncertainty. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the problems with securing grant funding. And on top of that, with all the sort of all the rumour and rhetoric around the visa regime, it's not exactly a welcoming climate. So you can certainly see how that might create an incentive for academics to look elsewhere, especially if, as you mentioned, they're receiving active approaches from other institutions.
Absolutely.
It would be very
yes.
easy for them to
yes.
leave.
Not to mention the old letter from the Home Office saying, leave now. Alison, is that something that you're picking up on as well?
Well, I mean, just to play devil's advocate slightly here, I would be intrigued to know how many staff at UCL are routinely approached. Because I mean... UCL is a fantastic institute, and I would expect actually 95% of its staff to be
in fact
sought after.
Something would be going wrong if they weren't, is what you're saying. Okay. Mike.
Well, I doubt Michael Arthur would highlight it so strongly if it were not different from before. But playing devil's advocate is a good thing. And to play devil's advocate further, it's been good to see that in the recent round of European Research Council grants, which is the very highly sought after one, the UK was back on top in first place in terms of landing those. And I think our most prestigious universities will continue to do well because they are prestigious. I worry about the middle band universities that have been doing very well from the whole European environment. Having said that about the ERC grants, there was a piece in Bloomberg recently interviewing Sir Andre Geim, one of the Nobel Prize winners and co-discoverers of graphene. And he said that right throughout this year, he has had no applications to work with him on Marie Curie grants from the EU, whereas usually he gets those year in, year out, and he's thinking about leaving. And so if someone at his level is thinking about leaving, then that's worrying. I wouldn't expect that. But yes, I mean, I get people saying writing to me via social media on a regular basis saying that they're leaving. And immediately after the Brexit vote happened, we did a survey on what the impact has been. And there was a lot of people citing xenophobia, sometimes very personal examples, people saying that their places on collaborative frameworks that are being planned are in doubt, or saying that they have intentions to leave, or saying that someone who was going to come has now turned it down. So we are seeing this slow sort of under the radar hemorrhaging of talent, of people more likely to leave and less likely to come in. And I think it's good that the UK government has now put science central to their industrial strategy and making all the right noises about funding, but they really need to set the right cultural tone for our country to actually be attractive to European immigrants and immigrants globally, in order for them to want to come and work in this environment.
Let's sort of move a little bit lower down the food chain, if that's not too rude a way to discuss it. Is there anything sensible that we can say? I mean, we're really kind of, you know, in the dark, aren't we, for much of this? But is there anything sensible we can say about student programs, particularly about Erasmus and about the, you know, the ability of and willingness of EU students, undergraduates, to come and study in Britain, and the capacity of British students to go and and live and work abroad. Do we any hints, any direction of where we might be going, Alison?
There's always been a strong asymmetry between the number of international students coming to the UK and the number of British students leaving to study abroad. Yeah, Britain is a very attractive study destination. It's second only to the US in the absolute numbers of students that it recruits, and international students. And when you think of the different population size between the US and the UK, that is extraordinary. And it's just because British universities are world class and people want to come and study here. And that's why I'm less concerned than Mike is about Brexit. I think that you know, ambitious EU nationals will still want to come and work in UK universities. And I think that ambitious EU students will also want to come. And there is actually a flip side, a slight sort of bonus looking just at the financials for British universities, because at the moment universities are only allowed to treat EU students in the same way as they treat their own, you know, local domestic
UK
students.
Nationals, yes, or
well, yeah, it's
nationals of whatever country we're talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, in England, EU students pay the same fees as English domiciled students. In Scotland, EU students pay no fees because Scottish domiciled students pay no fees. Now, after Brexit, that will change, and universities will be able to charge whatever the market will bear. So it may be that fewer students from the EU come, but they pay more money. And so actually the financial bottom line for British universities is better. In Scotland, there have been lots of concerns about EU students taking Scottish places. Reports in the papers there, you know, with Scottish students concerned that they've been denied their rightful place and it's gone instead to an EU national. Once the EU nationals are paying their own fees, then the caps on the Scottish places won't apply to them. And so that concern will be removed. I mean, there are a few
upsides. There's silver linings somewhere. Rachel, Erasmus, has the government said anything about Erasmus?
From what I understand, I don't think there's been any full clarity on Erasmus yet. It's quite a big deal for the UK in the sense that the UK is the top host country for Erasmus. So obviously that will impact the number of EU students coming if it's no longer a member. As with many other programmes, one of the conditions for the UK remaining a part of it will probably be connected with freedom of movement.
Mm.
But an alternative to that the government might consider would be it would probably be affordable to set up its own Erasmus scheme that would be able to allow student mobility to continue. And it might take more of a global approach as well. At the moment, UK students actually aren't as large participants in Erasmus as lots of other European countries. So on that side of things, it might not impact the type of study programmes that are on offer. But of course, lots of languages students in universities or prospective languages students are going to be quite worried about their year abroad and the funding that they receive to enable them to study at universities in EU. That's quite a big change to their course, and there aren't assurances around that yet.
Mm. Mike, have you heard any noises about Erasmus?
No, I haven't, because I think the government has just got far too much on its plate. So things that would otherwise be important are utterly sidelined. With university students, international university students, there are two levels here. One is the EU level, and then the other is global and more general. On the EU level, I think that Erasmus will probably be kept going by hook or by crook, by some way or another. We'll find a way to do it. We have already seen drops in applications to universities from EU students because of the uncertainty. I think when fees kick in, then that also would exacerbate that. And it is a shame to lose EU students because they are 1.5 times more likely to get a first-class degree, twice as likely to
go on. Is that so? I didn't realize that.
So they tend to be, you know, brighter, more adventurous, you know, because they're more mobile, and they come in and they not only add the culture, of course, and we keep forgetting this when we start analyzing the systems, how enriching it is to have that culture, but also they do help drive quality up and make links for our own students to then go and have those links internationally. So I think it would be sad to start squeezing them out and, squeezing them for money and all of that. But that's the way it is. The bigger picture is, however, that Theresa May is crazy on the matter of international students. And this is not controversial for me to say this because it has been the case that the cabinet had been thinking this not only currently, but also previously when she was Home Office.
Yeah.
To include international students in the overall immigration numbers is riddled with problems. Firstly, not even most Brits, when polled, think that that should be the case. Secondly, if she's saying this is for international comparisons, fine, you can use one number for international comparisons, but communicate to a home audience the split, the division, because people see a difference between it. And then also, we had recently the admission that we are not 90,000 students staying in the country after their degrees. It's more like 4,500 or 4,600, something like that. And the government have known this since 2015, but not said it, and allowed those figures not just to stand on their own right, but then also be included in the immigration figures, which of course drove Brexit. So there
they've been used as a justification for immigration policy.
Yeah. And this whole hostile attitude to international students, especially when Theresa May was Home Secretary, has had devastating effects on students from India, for example. In 2010, 40,000 students from India were in UK universities. It's dropped now to 17,000. Okay, this is from a Commonwealth country. It's dropped by over 50%, whereas they're increasing everywhere elsewhere. In Germany, it's now over 10,000 students from India in German universities. That's sad.
I mean, immigration is clearly has been a huge driver, was a huge driver in the Brexit vote. It's a huge driver in the current government's attitude to Brexit. Now that the government science position paper that was published earlier this month called for, and this is a very familiar phrase, a new, deep and special partnership with the EU. Isn't it the case that any kind of new, deep and special partnership simply isn't going to be possible with the kind of immigration policy that the government appeared to be spelling out in that leaked Home Office document that came to The Guardian a few days ago, the one that spoke of a two-year stay for low-skilled EU workers and a 3 to 5 year stay for residents for highly skilled workers, which clearly would include academics and researchers. I mean, free movement is surely, isn't free movement the key to whatever agreement around science and higher education Britain finally manages to reach with the EU? Alison?
I'm looking at this from a very sort of practical point. I don't think that we will be able to have free movement post-Brexit. I think that's one of the red lines. And so now we have to think about how to work around that, whether it's, you know, free exchange of ideas, whether it's sort of freedom to collaborate without spending too much time in each other's labs.
A lot of Skyping.
Those international partnerships absolutely are vital to the UK and must continue. And we now need to work out how to make that happen.
Mike, any clues?
Yeah, well, the thing about the government position paper was that it was absolutely right to say that this country wants to work closely with the EU on science, and the EU wants to work closely with the UK on science. That partnership works. It adds value. It's been doing really well. And the position paper just set out why that was the case and said it hopes for the same in the future.
Didn't give a great deal of detail about how to achieve that.
The problem is we're a quarter of the way through the time before coming out. There are clear obstacles that we all know. This paper did not lay out what those obstacles are, let alone solutions for them. And so with the sands of time running out, with a whole stack of frameworks that we want to leave on our plate, we really need to get on a move on with sorting this out. Now, with issues like freedom of movement, there are countries that participate in the EU science programme as associate members without having freedom of movement. Yes, they're outside Europe. They're like Israel and Tunisia and so forth and so on. But would the EU allow us to do something that is partial on free movement or something like that? We don't know because we haven't tested those waters. We haven't had those hard conversations. And also with funding of the budget, would they allow us to support Eastern European countries via our own mechanisms? We don't know. We haven't put that in the science position paper or started asking those questions. So we really need to get a move on with solutions if we want to stay in. Incidentally, with free movement, I think we can do everything that we want within immigration and controlling immigration within the free movement framework. Yeah, we have that 3-month limit. We can register people when they come to work like they do in Switzerland. I know I did that. Well, I didn't do it within 7 days of arriving, so I got fined. They're very strict like that. But then there's the Swiss deal that I told you about before, that you can prioritize nationals over internationals. There is so much flexibility within this framework.
We could do all that. We could have done all that without leaving the EU. That's the that's the irony of it. Rachel, the other big driver. Clearly, you know, that was all about taking back control of our borders, which is immigration, and taking back also control of our money, which is the amount that Britain pays into the EU budget or discrete parts of the EU budget. Now, there have been reports that the government might be prepared to spend up to, you know, maybe £1 billion or something to stay in EU science programmes. None of that's been confirmed. We certainly haven't had it from anybody in government. Do we think that's realistic? Do you think the government will have to pay a relatively substantial sum into the EU coffers in order to be able to maintain this deep and special relationship with EU science and higher education?
Well, with respect to the European research area, that's what happens to associate countries at the moment. There's certainly, when I've spoken to anyone on the EU side, there's a lot of resistance, the idea that the UK can just cherry pick the programmes it wants to be a part of and with the conditions that it wants attached. So it seems very unlikely that they wouldn't have to do that. The question mark is probably more over how much it would be. I know there are other projections based on what the smaller countries pay, which, taking into account the UK GDP, would be closer to £2 billion rather than the £1.3 billion that's been quoted. So I think they're going to find this quite a hefty membership bill.
Is that going to be an acceptable kind of number politically, Alison, do you think?
There's so much up in the air. I really don't know. But I think one of the really big problems that UK universities have with Brexit is they were campaigning very strongly on the losing side. And when Mike says, you know, the government's unclear about what to do next, you know, in other circumstances, the government might have turned to universities for help and advice, and that isn't happening. I can see why that's not happening. It would be enormously helpful if we weren't where we were, but we are.
But we are. Are there any positives in this? I mean, you've been trying hard throughout this episode to come up with silver. Any positives in Brexit for the higher education sector?
Well, you already know my positive on this because we were chatting about this before, which is the needed education from it. I mean, for all of these decades, we have been building up frameworks of collaboration internationally, whether in science, whether in health, whether in environment, and now tech and data, that have been completely off the radar in terms of national conversations about where our politics is going. And that's been no good. And also our government has been engaging with the EU, doing what it wants, and that has sometimes jarred with what's actually wanted at home. So if you think about Turkish accession, or if you think about eastward expansion, or even incandescent bulbs, these were all things that our government was pushing on the EU. But then these were all things that we were blaming the EU for during the referendum debate. So the education that we are having now about all of these frameworks that we are trying to leave actually is the conversations that we should have had before the referendum, but at some point we need to have that education about what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think it's beneficial for the rest of Europe to actually watch our plight and say, oh, I didn't know about that one. You know, they're getting free education from all of this.
Okay, well, we're beginning to run out of time. I'd just like one quick final sort of tour of the table. You know, the question I think really is, where the government now is on higher education and research, is it just another example of Britain or this government wanting to have its cake and eat it, cherry pick the best parts while, you know, sort of getting rid of any of the obligations? And can it be successful in that? Where will we be in, I don't know, 10 years' time? Where will British science and higher and British universities be in 10 years' time? Are you optimistic or pessimistic, Mike?
The sensible way to approach Brexit, if you were serious about it, would be to follow a model like Flexit, which was put out by Brexiteers years before we had this debate, led by Richard North and others, which involves firstly stepping into EEA and EFTA for a while, making sure that footing is stable there before then going on to the...
Full withdrawal, as it
were. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But what has happened is that we are doing a rush job on it. And because it's being driven by toxic politics and impatient politics and Veruca Salt politics, I want it now, Daddy, I don't care how, I want it now, we are in real danger of causing systems failure by pulling out of various frameworks at the same time and not even thinking them through fully, let alone their interactions. So for me, the issue is not whether you believe Brexit is a good thing or a bad thing, but rather the way it's being managed now by this government is actually quite reckless.
Mm. Rachel?
I think it's difficult to say what it will all look like because so much is up in the air at the moment. And the EU has said that it won't negotiate on science and research until the fundamentals
Article
are
50 is sorted
exactly,
out.
Yeah. And the things that they see as most important, like freedom of movement and the divorce bill. So before we've got to that stage, it's hard to predict what the future will be like for universities. I mean, in terms of student recruitment, there was a 5% drop in applications from EU students. Although, as Alison mentioned, if universities are able to charge international student fees, they might make up some of the drop in funding that comes through that. And there's also been a view that there might be higher numbers of international student applications from outside the EU, given the devalued pound. So that sort of remains to be seen what it'll be like for universities' bottom line. And again, there are going to be some institutions that suffer more than others. The top universities will probably never have a problem with recruitment in a way that those further down the rankings tables will.
Yes. Alison, can we make up the money? Can we?
So, I mean, British higher education at the moment faces two interfering pressures. Yeah, one is Brexit and the other is the new Higher Education Research Act, which was passed earlier this year. And that is, you know, deliberately creating competitive pressure on English universities. And it envisages some universities going to the wall. And it asks each university to, it requires them to write an exit strategy for what happens to their students when they go bust. And going back to what Mike was saying at the outset, I believe that, you know, in 10 years' time, the Oxfords and Cambridges of this world will be just fine. Mm. You know, they are one of the oldest institutions in the world. They predate the rise of the modern state.
Global reputation for excellence.
Global reputation. They will still be here in 10 years' time. It's those institutions that have been, you know, very quietly getting on with supporting local economic growth, recruiting EU students, and, you know, modestly, you're working in... Yeah, but the unfashionable parts of the UK, those are the ones that,
are the ones that might be in danger. Okay, well, thank you very much, all of you. That is it for this week. My thanks to Rachel Hall, Alison Goddard, Mike Galsworthy for joining me. Please do subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. If you want to get in touch about Brexit, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. And if you'd like to review the pod and be in with a chance of featuring in our podcast weekly column, then please email podcasts@theguardian.com. Till next week then, I'm John Henley, the producer is Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.